Welcome to the Changing State of Talent Acquisition, where your hosts, Graham Thornton and Martin Pred, share their unfiltered takes on what's happening in the world of talent acquisition today. Each week brings new guests who share their stories on the tools, trends, and technologies currently impacting the changing state of talent acquisition. Have feedback or want to join the show? Head on over to changestate.io. And now, on to this week's episode.
Welcome back. Super excited about our next guest, Lori Rudiman. I'm going to go on a limb and say most, if not all, of our listeners probably already know who Lori is. But Lori, I'm going to turn it over to you and say, for those who don't know you, who is Lori Rudiman? And maybe tell a little bit more about your background.
Well, there's nothing like someone talking about themselves to turn off a podcast audience, so I'm just going to be real careful here. I am Lori Rudiman. I'm a writer, speaker, and entrepreneur, but before all of that, I was an HR lady who hated her job a whole lot and tried to figure out a new way of doing work. And so I went on this journey over a decade ago to fix work. And I find myself talking to executives, recruiters, HR professionals, job seekers, freelancers about how jacked up work is nearly every day. So that's my life.
That's awesome. And that means we're going to have a lot of stuff to talk about. So with that said, I know you write a lot. And you know, let's start with what's most exciting, I think, for us, right? So you have a book coming out, and probably for you too, I would hope. But you have a book coming out. It's called Betting on You. Can you, tell us a little bit more about your upcoming book first?
Well, thanks for asking. Again, forgive me, everybody, for being self-promotional, but I do have a book coming out. It is exciting for me. And I really tried to take all the career advice books I've ever read and throw them in the trash and write something for people who hate career advice books. So I tell stories about the world of work and I kind of go along the HR life cycle, but this is not an HR book. I just try to speak truth around hiring, employment, experience, training, development, using four principles that have really guided me throughout my career. And that is self-leadership, individual well-being, continuous learning, and risk-taking. But if I use those four phrases, nobody would ever read the book. So I just tell stories. That's all I do.
That's awesome. Well, I think that storytelling is, sometimes a lost art. And, I remember, someone either had on last week or reading a blog post. It's like, stories will always be in Excel. And one of the books that we talk about a lot here is a book called How to Lie with Statistics. And, I always think about like the parallels between, looking at stats and, being in, let's just say the recruitment space and like, hey, people are buying your products. They're buying your companies based on the stories you tell too. So, storytelling is by far a lost art.
Yeah, really well said. I do have like this 2x2 quadrant that I use in my coaching business and I have this whole methodology, but I really tried to get people to understand that if work could be fixed in a 7-point program, it would already be fixed. The only way to fix work is to fix yourself, to double down on well-being, to really learn how to take risks, to continue to invest in your learning, and to be individually accountable for your outcomes. And if you do that for yourself and you work in human resources or recruiting, you're going to fix work for other people. So there's just this weird tension in our audience that recruiters and HR professionals forget that they're employees too. And unless they're born of generational wealth, they have to work and they have to care for their careers for their entire lives.
Yeah, I think that's super interesting. And, we talk about a lot of people that have gotten into HR and talent acquisition, for the people aspect. And, I think if there's one thing that we've noticed, we're recording this at the tail end of 2020, right? And I think that is certainly one of the more challenging years that we've probably all had. We'll go on a limb. And, I think that, we're talking to one of my mentors and, they talk about one of the other pieces that's a lost art is, just the lost art of being empathetic, and bringing that back in. And, they shared about the context of, there are so many leaders that are also in the space that have also not, no one's lived through COVID, right? No one's gone through this type of experience too. And, I think that we could all deal with a little bit more of a dose of empathy across all levels.
Love it. Really well said. The real interesting thing about the world is that it's so easy to give sympathy and empathy and compassion to other people and very difficult to do it for yourself. But if you are not kind and empathetic to yourself, you are a terrible employee. You are a terrible leader. And it shows in your work output. I just believe that there's such strong carryover when you elevate the personal, you improve the professional. So it's time that we stop talking about kindness and empathy and compassion as these esoteric concepts and apply them to ourselves. Because if we're kinder to ourselves, if we're more empathetic, our performance will improve. We will feel better about the world, and our relationship with work and our colleagues and our supervisors is going to get a heck of a lot better. And we need that. We need better relationships at work to survive this crazy thing called COVID, because it's not over.
Yeah, Lori, I really like this idea of, I mean, it's kind of getting back to, I think this is a Gandhi quote, but sort of being the change that you seek in the world, starting with the individual rather than starting with the organization. I mean, I think we can all take that perspective to heart, and it clearly, starting by focusing on yourself will likely lead to changes in a more organizational sense. But I'm wondering if you could comment a bit about a quote that we saw on your blog recently where you said, you know, changing our workplace environments can't just be about changing the employee. Rather, organizations need to change around the employee. To my ear, that almost sounds like the opposite of that. It almost sounds like you're saying you're not expecting the employee to change, but the organization actually has to change. Is there a tension there, or how do you see that quote fitting in with this perspective of starting with the individual?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a real interesting quote you pulled, and I think both things can be true. In fact, employees are always growing. They're always changing, hopefully for the better, sometimes not, but there's always flux and even slack within your workforce, right? I mean, people come, people go, and the workforce today is not the workforce you're going to have in 3 months. And oftentimes, leaders, HR professionals, recruiters swoop in with systems and policies and programs that are made on tons of assumptions and are built with bias. And we expect these programs to have positive outcomes. And often they don't. I mean, how many initiatives have we implemented as talent leaders in our lives that have really gone nowhere? You know, I can name probably five off the top of my, you know, head of things that are real big projects that I thought were going to change the world of work when I worked in HR that were just a bust. And that's because I wasn't thinking about the workforce that we had right now, the workforce we would have in the future. I think organizations have to be in constant conversation with employees, whether that's through technology or good old-fashioned words to words, ears to ears. But we have to be in dialogue with one another in order to be in a healthy relationship with one another. You know, if you're married, you don't just expect your spouse to do all the work, and then you don't do all the work and your spouse just slacks off. You expect that both of you come to the table and work on having an equal partnership. And I think some of that needs to happen in the workforce as well.
Yeah, for sure. I love this idea of having a constant conversation with your employees. You know, we're an agency, so we do a lot of talent insights work. And one of the surprising things, or maybe it's not so surprising anymore when we enter an engagement with a client, is, you know, organizations often have a very big picture idea of what they think that their employer brand is. Mm-hmm. And then you actually talk to them and it turns out that how did they come up with this idea? Well, it probably lives in the boardroom or it lives in the executive's office. And if you actually ask them, did you talk to your employees and find out what they think your brand is? There's silence in the room. Yes. And some of the biggest insights that we get out of our projects are actually talking to employees. I mean, it's quite simple and quite obvious, really. But a lot of organizations just don't do that. And I think you're saying a similar thing when you think about the employee experience.
Yes.
You know, these initiatives are only going to work if it actually starts by having a real dialogue with employees. I think that's what you're saying.
I am. You know, there's nothing like somebody creating an experience for you that you didn't ask for and you had no input on. You know,
yeah.
I think about one time my dad, when I was a kid, surprised me and said, and we grew up in the city of Chicago, he said, I've got plans for us this weekend. And I'm like, Dad, that's great. What are we doing? We're going to see the Indianapolis time trials. Well, I was like a punk rock kid. I don't want to drive to Indy and watch a bunch of cars go in a circle. That was not my idea of fun. And every time an employer is like, we're going to do this great event or this great program, I'm like, did you talk to anybody about that? I don't think so. That sounds terrible. So I think we're aligned. Constant conversation, constant communication. It's tough. It's not easy. But if 2020 taught us anything, now is the time to do it. Otherwise, you end up with a whole host of other problems down the road.
Oh, that's 100% accurate. And I always think about, you know, context as a missing piece in all of these communications, right? And like, Yeah, I think about a, my sister loves buying things for my dad. And then, you know, every like clockwork, she's going to listen to this and be super
like clockwork, a week after, on your sister.
A week after this happens, like, my dad tells me, like, I don't know why she's buying this. I didn't need this. And, like, you know, my sister gets mad. She's like, wow, he never appreciates anything I buy.
Yeah.
I'm like, wow. I guess it's, you know, why don't you just talk to each other? I don't understand why I'm the middle person on all this. And,
families, work.
Yeah, but that same context on the employee engagement side, too. Like, you know, the context now is, you know, it's not a shock, or it shouldn't be a shock, that, you know, like, individuals care more about, you know, having a safe work environment, a clean and sanitary workspace, which, you know, 9 months ago, like, that, the context of how important it was to, you know, restructure and set up your office and, you know, have, you know, cleaning crews in there at certain intervals, no one paid attention to it.
For
like,
sure.
You know, the context continues to shift, and you don't know what's important if you don't ask. And I think we forget about it so often, either that or we ask and we don't do anything with it. And that's, I don't even know what's worse, right?
Well, I think there's a reason why we don't do anything with it, because we ask because we think, oh, we have to, but we don't care. And I would rather have an employer who said, I've got a vision, this is what I believe in, I'm, you know, operating on it, versus an employer who is faking it. You know, at least be the company you say you are. Like, you know, for years, GE had a way of operating and they were profitable and they were successful, and GE just ran with it and they didn't apologize for it. And so there was no confusion in their employer brand. It was like, this is the way GE operates. You know what you get. What's worse now are these companies that are trying to be human and trying to make a human-to-human connection, and they muck it up because they don't mean it.
Yeah, this idea of, it's funny you say that, Lori, because, you know, oftentimes one of the first questions we ask clients when we onboard them is, you know, do you do any employee engagement surveys? Do you do any employee satisfaction surveys? And almost invariably the answer is, oh, yes, we do it every week, right, every quarter. We've got tons of data. And then when the next question is, well, what are you doing with the information? Oftentimes the clients cannot even find out where the latest report is or how to access their dashboard. And the answer is, our point is always, you're actually almost undermining the employee experience further by asking people for their feedback and then not doing anything in response to it. And I think this is a perfect illustration of your point, which is that there's a lot of box checking. People are saying, like, oh, we need to have an ESAT program. We need to be doing these surveys on a regular interval, but it's not really genuine. They're not actually interested in the answers to the questions, which further leads to a further breakdown, I think.
Well said. Absolutely. All right. Well, we identified what's wrong with work. I don't know how to fix it, dudes. I have no idea.
Well, I tell you how we don't fix it, right? I don't think we fix it by just checking a box.
No, but yeah, of course.
Yeah, the other challenge that we have here is, like, you know, it's, we can't fix things overnight. And I think that's the other challenge. And boy, like, you know, we talk about the spirit of, you know, the spirit of progress. And this is why we like having these conversations. It's like, we want, like, we recognize that we can't, you know, we can't fix the diversity of, you know, our leadership team overnight. But we have to be able to commit to making a change and, like, hey, recognize what benchmarks are in place or how we're going to measure progress.
Really,
and it can't just be a check the box.
Well, you know, the other thing is, you can't change things overnight. So a lot of people go, then I'm not even going to try. And I think continuous improvement is something that's really important. Even the best, most optimized TA departments need to be focused on continuous improvement and meeting new and, quite frankly, challenging goals. Because if you're not learning and growing, you're not thriving. And if you're not thriving, what's the point? I mean, to just rest on your laurels from yesterday is boring. It doesn't attract or retain talent. And so many organizations right now are patting themselves on the back. Look at the way we handled COVID. Look at the way we handled the Black Lives Matter movement. And frankly, I don't know why anybody would applaud themselves for that, but they are. There are brands that are like, we feel like we've had this diversity conversation nailed. And it's like, all right, you may feel that way. What's your organization look like in 3 months, in 6 months, in a year? Like, what is the downstream effect of all this good work? And how do you make it better? Like, I'm not for any company patting itself on the back. And yet I see a lot of that in the marketplace today.
Well, I think this is a great conversation, Lori. So this is the challenge that we have, right? So it's because everyone was told, hey, you have to, here's the script that you have to read to say that you care. And, you know, we also see organizations when we talk about, you know, committing to diversity hiring. It's, you know, hey, like, you could be the largest sourcing platform and you say, hey, here's where we're at. This is our diversity report. We put this out every year. And everyone says, ah, we'll pat you on the back. Great. They put it out every year. But no one looks at the numbers and says, whoa, whoa, whoa. These numbers are getting worse.
That's right. Some of the biggest technology companies are failing year after year and actually declining. And yet we're not having those conversations. We're applauding the effort of reporting and not the content of the report. So I hear you loud and clear. I think this is just part of a broader conversation that the world of hiring has been so commoditized and commodified. There's just like a lot of money in it, a lot of products in it. Everybody's trying to get theirs. And the worker tends to get lost. And so really, it's my hope, whether through it's my book or through my writing, to remind people that the worker is the very reason why you have a company. At least right now, the robots are not doing everything. And for workers, you have power, you have agency. If your organization is operating in a way that totally sucks, you don't have to stay. There's this thing called self-leadership that you can express. You don't have to quit today, but you can start working on a plan. The way democracy works is through voting. And the way we vote in a capitalistic society is by leaving our jobs. That's what I believe.
No, vote with your feet. That's what everyone, you know, that's heard that way too many times on Saturday morning, you know, trail runs over here. But so that's an interesting pivot. You know, I want to talk a little bit more about the employee experience, right? So, you know, you try to put a lot of focus on, you know, better understanding, you know, employees' experience and, you know, their sort of perspective. And, you know, obviously that resonates with us, you know, quite a bit on the candidate experience side, you know, and I'm curious, you know, are there any lessons that, you know, you continually see on the employee experience side that you think, you know, might resonate on the, you know, talent experience side when it comes to improving the overall experience?
Well, I think there's this weird thing that happens at work. When you show up either for an interview or for a job, you lose control of the calendar. So whether you're a candidate and the calendar just becomes this amorphous thing that you're not in charge of, and you interview when you interview and you show up when you show up and maybe you get a response or maybe you don't, there's that. And then it becomes the employee experience where your Outlook calendar just drives your day and you don't feel like you can say no. I believe, and this is something I teach in my book and my coaching practice, that there are things you can do, things you can say in the interview process that signal that you're in charge in a non-threatening way. And then when you become an employee, there are boundaries that you can set, you can practice to really make sure that your Outlook calendar or your Gmail calendar doesn't become a hellscape. And I think the two are related, but there's just something about whether you're a candidate or you're an employee that you feel like you give up your rights to time. And you don't. Like, your time is yours. You can say yes or no. You can make suggestions. You can be in conversation with your interviewer or your boss. You know, a moment in time is not written in stone. Like, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But a lot of people just feel like they don't have the power to say no.
That's interesting. I mean, I like that idea. I want to push back slightly. Like, when we think about the candidate experience, like, why is it that you think, like, notoriously companies are just horrible about the candidate experience? Even companies that purport to have a good employee experience once you've actually been hired. You know, people will apply for jobs and it's almost routine just to not expect to get a response.
Yeah,
you know,
it's terrible. It's terrible.
And so you could say, on the one hand, sure, you know, you could put yourself out there and say, I have boundaries and I, you know, this is my time and I expect a certain standard from these companies that I'm considering working for. But if you need a job and nobody's responding to you, and that's just the norm, I mean, it does feel like the employee or the candidate is really at a disadvantage there.
Absolutely. I mean, that's 100% true. And one of the things that I love about this emerging social landscape that we have is we can start to speak truth to power. You know, not enough work is being done to really capture in real time candidate feedback and put it out in an open sourced way. Like, I would love to know, you know, if someone applies for a job, what's the true experience? I mean, we have Glassdoor, we have Fairy Godboss, but all of that is filtered and sanitized and ultimately meant to monetize the employer. I am looking for a real conversation about what it's like. The closest I can get to that at any given point is to go on some of the subreddits and look at different employers and look at the employee experience and the candidate experience, and you can see it there. But I think a really intrepid entrepreneur is going to find a way to get that conversation and get it in real time in the hands of other job seekers. And that's when you start to flip power. And that's what I'm talking about, because you're right. If you're desperate for a job right now, it's very difficult to say, you know what, I can't come in on Tuesday morning because I've got this thing, but I can come in on Wednesday afternoon. It's scary. But the other thing is, not enough of us do it. And so we're not training employers to understand that we as interviewees have power. So I don't know. It's like a chicken and an egg thing, but I'm waiting for that entrepreneur to really open source that feedback.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. I mean, we spent a lot of time thinking about Glassdoor, and I think we have a similar perspective. It's also funny to me. It kind of reminds me of dating a little bit. I always, Grandma rolls eyes because I always use this tired analogy of dating. But you know, if you're dating someone, you're very interested in them, you're almost over eager and accommodating, it's actually a pretty big turnoff. And I think you're saying a similar thing about candidates applying for jobs. If you don't set any boundaries and you don't value your own time, then it's going to be hard to expect the employer to actually value your time.
Well, I think that's a part of it. You know, dating, at least there's some semblance of power equality there. You know, you can both swipe the... I have to tell you, I haven't been on a date in like 20 years. So I don't know anything about this. I'm married. But, you know, now you can swipe one way or swipe the other. And there's like some inherent power that you have. When you're looking for work or when you're employed, it feels like there's no power. It can feel like you're stuck. It can feel like you're not the boss of your life. And I think it's my life's work to help people really feel, first of all, more in control of their own individual lives, and then to take that energy and bring it to work. And once we start to do more of that en masse, it teaches the employer that they just can't get away with it anymore. So yeah, I think we're saying similar things, but I'm always wary about the dating thing because, you know, If your boss doesn't like you, you're out. But if you don't like your boss, what do? You look for another job. You stick around. You know, so it's not the same power there.
That's my area of expertise, I suppose, in this conversation.
Dave, tell us more.
Well, we'll use as you can say. I do think that's an interesting piece about giving power back to the candidate and how you do that. You know, I almost wonder if. You know, you've spoken about the future of independent workers, the gig economy. You know, if part of the reason that we've seen such growth in the gig economy is because candidates want more flexibility. I mean, obviously the answer is yes, right? I mean, we've certainly seen a rise in freelance workers.
We have, but you know, companies are cheap, and they regress to being cheap whenever they can be. Cheap. Let me say that one more time. Companies are stinking cheap. Like, I can't say that enough. And I think, you know, freelance work is one way to reduce costs, to reduce labor, to reduce risks. And so when they can, the new, not so new, trendy world is to hire freelance labor. That being said, there are a lot of really powerful, educated, sincerely passionate individuals who prefer freelance work for that reason that you mentioned: autonomy, you know, individual accountability. They can do other things besides work. I think it's an interesting stratified conversation because more people are freelancers because they have to be than they choose to be. That's where the economy is right now. And we don't have a social net to make people who freelance as powerful as they could be if they were workers. So it's a real precarious situation that a lot of people find themselves in. So I'm not sure the answer to empowering the worker is to make them freelance. The answer is actually, like anything, is money. Freelancers need access to healthy well-being benefits. They need access to dental benefits. They need access to savings and retirement plans that are favorable to them. And these things do not exist consistently across the United States. We need a guaranteed minimum income. I believe in basic income as a solution to encourage everybody to go into the freelance market and do what they're good at, but we have a floor for everybody so that people don't fall into poverty. It's just one of my grand theories in life that money fixes things, and money and investment is one way to fix this freelance and, quite frankly, this whole employment market.
Well, and I also think about that in the context of entrepreneurship and the ability to take risks, right?
Looking
at European countries, you have a fallback if you're in Denmark and you want to go decide that you want to spend 6 months and see if you could start your own wine shop, right? Like, you can do that, and if it doesn't work, like, you're not going to end up on the street, right?
That's for sure.
You know, in the U.S., it's hey, the first step to getting a professional job is oh, go to college and, you know, we'll hit you with a $150,000 bill. And like,
that's right.
Oh, you
that's
don't have
right.
a job? Like, well, you don't have healthcare either. You better get a job. Right. And you know, like it de-incentivizes risk on so many levels.
A lot of people though believe that because we don't have health insurance and because we have a make it or break it way of living in the United States, that's why the US has the greatest number of new businesses that start. And that's why we're so entrepreneurial. I think that's stupid. I think one of the reasons why we're so entrepreneurial is because people who have come here, immigrants, self-select in, and they just have this attitude of, you know, I'm going to make it. This is the land of dreams. And there's something about the culture of this country that does that. It's not because we don't have a safety net. But a lot of people do believe that the safety net would take some of the intensity out of entrepreneurship. I actually think it's the thing that would unlock entrepreneurship. And it's one of the greatest challenges we have of the 21st century. How do we redistribute some of this wealth? How do we pay people a dividend on the free labor that they're doing at Facebook and Twitter by clicking on links? How do we make sure they get their money back? They get their money's worth even so that they can go on and follow their dreams, just like Mark Zuckerberg, just like Jack Dorsey, just like all of these guys. I believe basic income is part of that answer, but you know, me and Andrew Yang, that's about it. You know, not a big crew.
I was just gonna say, yeah, it was encouraging to see Andrew Yang kind of make it into the public consciousness in the recent election, although obviously he didn't make it as far as some of us would have liked. I totally agree with you on the universal basic income point. I mean, Graham and I started this business. You know, we've come from some privilege ourselves, so it maybe wasn't the same risk that others would have had. But still, I think there were definitely moments along the way, Graham, where you and I both felt like, wow, if this doesn't turn around in the next 3 months, we may have to actually go get a job.
That's right.
And yeah. I don't think having the prospect of, you know, saying a guaranteed $3,000 a month check or something in the form of universal basic income would have been a deterrent to us starting this business. It would have certainly given us a lot of peace of mind and probably reassured us in some of those lower points. So we stayed the course towards actually starting our business.
That's right. That's right. I love that take on that. And I think, you know, the one thing that Andrew did, you know, and like he's my best friend, he was on my podcast once, right? So the one thing that Andrew did, though, was really get this conversation going. It had been something that was talked about with academics and even tech executives who were starting to feel guilty about all this public money that they were taking in along with profit. And I mean, there's a ton of investment money that we've given to Facebook and Instagram and, you know, all of it to really get them to be the successful behemoths that they are, and they don't give back. They really, truly don't give back. In fact, a lot of these tech companies are making life worse, and they recognize this, and they want to be part of the solution. So they know it's basic income. You know who doesn't know it? Marco Rubio, Mitch McConnell, you know, all of these politicians. And that's the frustrating thing. But that's also the interesting thing, gentlemen, because recruiters and HR professionals sit at this intersection of work, power, politics, and money. So if you believe something, you can actually make a difference in all of those realms. And that's why I think this job is cool.
That's fantastic. I think that's a really good point. You know, I always think, you know, if it's free, you are the product or whatever that phrase is. And, you know, we talk so much about how, you know, we watch consumer trends and all of our recommendations to our clients and like to what we do from a recruitment marketing standpoint. And, you know, I think about, I have some friends that work in the consumer marketing space, and like they will, you know, sell, you know, the coupons that print out at the end of the grocery store when we all used to go to the grocery store. and like the amount of data that like these credit card companies are selling or like these consumer agencies collect on you.
Yeah,
it's
that's
like,
right.
Like they know, like back in the day, they knew like to the square, like when your toilet paper was about to run out, like when to print that ad when you made it to the end of
yeah.
that. It is unbelievable. That's my horrible sheet,
but No. I meant gross. I mean, of the surveillance. I mean, it's just terrible. And, you know, I read all these books because that's like one thing that I love to do. I love to read. And I try to escape this world that we're in. And I read these sci-fi books around the digital apocalypse. I'm like, oh, that doesn't sound so bad. You know, this is actually really beautiful. There's no way to communicate with people and nobody's spying on me anymore. Sign me up.
Marty and I talk about this probably in his eyes, probably way too often, but like, hey, like fast forward 12 months, we got to get a one bedroom cabin in the woods and we'll just alternate like whoever wants it for a month. It's like, I got to get off the grid once in a while.
Oh,
it's
been, yeah, for sure.
Too much talking. too much talking over the last few months, for sure.
I am definitely done communicating with humans, even though I'm compassionate and empathetic and all that stuff. You're right. I mean, COVID has forced me to have a lot of conversations, especially through the computer, and I am burnt out. So I would like to rent that cabin for a month. So you just let me know where I can write the check.
Well, speaking from working from a cabin, Lori, another topic that's, you know, been on our minds and a lot of people's minds in the space lately is this rise of remote work. I think COVID has obviously thrust a lot of people into working from home and thrust organizations to allowing work from home that previously were not necessarily open to it. I would love to get your take on this. Do you think this is a trend that we're going to see continue after the pandemic lifts into 2021 and beyond?
You know, I'm not sure. Because first of all, such a small portion of our society truly works from home. I mean, you know, is it 30%? Is it 40%? Not 40%. There's some numbers in the New York Times that talk about it, but it's smaller than we think, and it tends to be elite. And the one thing I know about CEOs, because I'm talking to them, because I hear them, right, is that they have an ego, and they really want people to come back to work for a lot of reasons. They want community. They want to be able to see the workers that they pay. They want better communication. They recognize that people are actually working too many hours at home, and they think that bringing them back into the office would create some sort of normal systems and processes. So I don't know. I think there are a lot of leaders out there who think remote work is fine, and they understand that talented people may not want to come back to the office, but they also recognize the benefit of working in a cohabitated space. Now, I will say, I'm a little worried that some companies are going to push to get people back sooner than appropriate. That's kind of been on my mind. Like, I'm thinking about worker safety. I'm thinking about protection. It's hard to get tested in some states. PPE is not accessible for everybody. And as I think about remote work, if your employer, whether you're a recruiter, a TA professional, or a consultant, is demanding that you come on site, are you strong enough to ask really good questions? Are you skilled enough to do it? Well, the time to start asking awkward questions is now. In the small moments, you want to practice that before you're like thrust into the spotlight and you're super nervous. So I think these are the kinds of conversations we're going to have in 2021. And I just want HR leaders and talent leaders to be ready for it.
Yeah, I think we're far past the point of waiting to have a plan. I think if there's one thing that we've learned, like, over the last year, it was, one quarter where everyone sat and was paralyzed, too paralyzed to make a decision. You know, then it was, there was 3 months of every contingency plan known to man. Then it was, hey, this is the reality. And I think now, like, hopefully the smart businesses are paying attention to what 2021 is going to look like. You know, I think that, boy, there are a lot of big buildings and a lot of big cities, that are empty right now. And there's going to be a lot of public pressure to get people back in the office as soon as we can.
That's right.
You know, I think that's the same concern that you have. It's, the pressure to sort of reinvigorate these cities is going to be pretty strong. And, hopefully we take a pragmatic approach and, maybe a data-driven or science-driven approach to managing risk and, what's an appropriate return to normalcy. Right.
Well, I hope so. From your lips to God's ears, man. I don't have a lot of faith in humanity, so we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to end without the faith in humanity, but I do that's close to a good place for us to end. So, I guess this is how we're kicking off 2021, Lori. So, I would say what's a good closing thought, from you as we do kick off 2021? And then I'd say where's the best place for people to find you online, find a little bit more, and pre-order your book?
Well, I believe in this crazy idea of continuous learning. I think if you're not learning, you're not growing, right? I've said this. And if you're not growing, you're not thriving. And one of the ways that people learn and grow is through reading. And so I don't care that I have a new book out, but I think the new year offers a lot of opportunities for people to start a new reading habit. all the great CEOs read, all the great people leaders read. And even if you just commit to like one book every other month or one book a quarter, I think that's a really important goal. And it doesn't have to be mine. And if you're looking for book recommendations, talk to me. I am like a concierge when it comes to this stuff. So I'm happy to make a recommendation. But you can reach me through my website at punkrockhr.com. And I'm happy to talk about books you should read, my own book, my ideas on work, or my foster puppies and kittens, whatever you want to talk about.
Ooh, foster puppies. We could talk about that for a while. But Well, thanks for coming on the show, Lori. It's been quite a treat for me, and I'm sure Graham as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Punk Rock HR. I mean, music's right up there and a key to my heart. So perfect. All right. Thanks, Lori. Appreciate having you on the show. And we'll be back next week. All right. Thanks for tuning in. As always, head on over to changestate.io or shoot us a note on all the social media. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll check you guys next week.